Thank you.
It's pretty up there.
Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development for Friday, March 6th. We have a busy agenda today. Have you ever been scheduled so that you have to be in two places at one time? I have to be in three places at one time this morning, so you may see me jumping in and out. We have capable vice chairs who will be taking the gavel at those points. So please don't react as if it's something anyone has said when you see me go scurrying out of here. We need to start with a work session on House Bill 3063. As a matter of reminder, Victoria, could you bring us up to speed again, please?
Sure. Oh, you have them. Here, why don't I take those? There we go. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3063 appropriates monies to Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development to be expended for grant program that distributes monies to community colleges to increase number of underserved, low-income, and first-generation college-bound students who enroll in community colleges and make progress toward degree or certificate, declares an emergency, and is effective July 1, 2015.
Thank you. This is our third experience with this bill, having heard the general discussion of it and then the specific public hearing on it earlier. We're ready. Representative Gallegos?
Sure. Chair Reed, I move House Bill 3063 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Gallegos moves House Bill 3063 to the floor with the due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. House Bill 3063 heads to the floor and on to the Ways and Means Committee. Close the work session on House Bill 3063 and open the work session on House Bill 2410. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2410 allows community colleges to award training certificates for non-credit courses and programs, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. You have dash one amendments proposed, which require community colleges to ensure that new non-credit courses for training certificates do not adversely impact other public or private post-secondary educational institutions.
Thank you. Representative Wisner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members, remember, this is the bill that I asked it, and I appreciate the community college working with private universities and the LC to come up with an amendment, which you have before you, the dash one, which just states policy was already there, but we found a way to restate it to be sure there is not an adverse effect, that there is a need for this by the community colleges. So I appreciate all the work, and I ask you to support the dash one and pass the bill.
Good. Representative, do you have a motion then on the dash one?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I move the committee approve House Bill 2410-1 as amended. I'd have to do the amendment first.
Yes, please.
I move the dash one into House Bill 2410.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2410. Is there any discussion of that motion? Wait for a moment so Representative Reardon is here. We're talking about the dash one amendments to House Bill 2410. No problem. As Representative Wisnett explained, restates the adverse impact process for community colleges. So the motion has been to move those dash one amendments. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. The dash one amendments are adopted. Representative Wisnett?
Mr. Chair, I move the committee pass House Bill 2410-1 is amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Wisnett has moved House Bill 2410 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendations. Is there any discussion of that motion? Any objections to that motion? Seeing none, the motion carries. House Bill 2410 as amended goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Wisnett, would you be willing to carry?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Wisnett will carry on the floor and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2410. With that, we're going to proceed to a discussion of the individual development account tax credits. We have a number of bills on that topic. So I think we're going to open public hearings concurrently on House Bill 2011, 2111, 2112, and 2441. I think that's the That's all of them. Victoria.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2011 expands allowable purposes for establishment of individual development accounts as specified, allows money in accounts to be rolled over into college savings accounts or individual retirement accounts. Personal development plans are met, extends the sunset of tax credits for both withdrawals from individual development accounts and donations to fiduciary organizations for distribution to individual development accounts. House Bill 2111 extends the sunset for withdrawals from individual development accounts. House Bill 2112 extends the sunset for tax credits for individual development account donations. And House Bill 2441 expands the allowable purposes for establishing individual development accounts, extends sunset on tax credits for donations to fiduciary organizations for distribution to individual development accounts, extends the sunset on tax credits for withdrawals from individual development accounts used to purchase primary residences.
Thank you very much. This is another example, committee, of the tax credits that are working their way through our regular process. Without action by the legislature, they will sunset. So it's our job to hear testimony, to consider whether they should be extended, if they should be modified in one way or another. And we have a number of people who are expert on that to talk to us today. We'll start with Claire Seguin. I hope I have that pronounced somewhat close. Jessica Junkie and Rebecca Barker, please. Barger, sorry. We're happy to hear from you in whatever order you prefer.
Thank you. I'll start. Great. Good morning, Chair Reed and committee members. Thank you so much for seeing us this morning. My name is Claire Seguin, and I'm the Assistant Director of Housing Stabilization at OHCS. And one of the best parts of my job in my role there is that I get to oversee the IDA program. This program is an amazing program for Oregonians for so many ways, and I have been very familiar with it the last few years. I have been working at a nonprofit prior to my role at OHCS, and I have seen its good work and its impact on Oregonians time and time and time again, and so I'm very proud to be here to speak to you in a little bit more detail about that. Individual development accounts are available to low-income Oregonians who receive financial education while they're saving to build an asset. It's a matched savings program, and it has two primary components: the state tax credit, which funds the program, and the initiative, which helps provide the matched savings. IDAs are an essential strategy which supports our vision for Oregon. Our vision is that all Oregonians have the opportunity to pursue prosperity and live free from poverty. The IDA program is a key contributor to the prosperity and opportunity and housing stability for all Oregonians who are eligible. This initiative has often helped families buy their first home. It's helped send kids and adults to college, and it's helped start new businesses to increase family incomes and change the pathway out of poverty for folks who have really put in the time and the effort that's necessary. It's a wonderful combination of education and practical habit-changing saving patterns that's really effective. Oregon Housing and Community Services has a bill, HB 2441, which extends the sunset on the tax credit for both the donors and the participants and expands the purposes for which people can save. Our bill, HB 2441, doesn't do quite as much as Bill 2011 does. That was submitted after ours and as a result of ongoing dialogue with our good partnership network. The program's structure is such that a nonprofit organization, Neighborhood Partnerships, who you'll hear from, receives the donations which fund the program, and OHCS provides all of the oversight for the program. Together, OHCS and Neighborhood Partnerships manage the initiative. Neighborhood Partnerships has been the designated manager since 2003 and has done an outstanding job with this program for the state of Oregon. We have the appropriate oversight, we have the right systems, we have the participants who now are on waiting lists to get into this program, we have the impact that we evaluate regularly, and in a nutshell, this is an amazing opportunity for Oregonians, and we appreciate your consideration today of all the bills and hope that you will see its value going forward. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Jessica Yenke. I'm the Director of Economic Opportunity at Neighborhood Partnerships. As Ms. Seguin said, NP is the administrator of the Oregon IDA Initiative. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We know that Oregon communities thrive when people with lower incomes have the opportunity to build more stable financial households through asset building programs like the Oregon IDA Initiative. We hope at the end to have your support in renewing and expanding this proven tool through House Bill 2011. With our statewide partners, we have developed all of the new proposals that are incorporated into House Bill 2011, so that was built on robust conversation and dialogue across the state over the past few years. Today, we will share an overview of how the Oregon IDA Initiative works, a sense of the impacts we're having in communities across the state, as well as, of course, the specifics of our legislative proposal. Each of us has prepared a very short statement for you to respect your time constraints. At the end, our Executive Director, Janet Bird, is prepared to take all of the questions that you may have. So just to go over the basics really quickly, as Claire mentioned, individual development accounts are accounts opened at a financial institution by an Oregonian with a household income below 80% area median or 200% poverty level, as well as an eligible net worth of less than $20,000. Each participant starts with an allowable savings goal, and we have five currently. Those are first-time home ownership, education, small business development or expansion, as well as home repair and assistive technology related to employment. That savings goal that they start the program with and they bring in themselves is woven throughout their journey, guided by their personal development plan, which includes financial education, coaching and counseling specific to that goal, as well as, of course, the required monthly savings deposits into the account. After they've completed all of the requirements, their savings is matched with, is eligible for match with state dollars, and all of that goes directly to the vendor for that asset purchase. So as I said, IDAs meet participants where they're at, building off of the goals that they bring with them, and that flexibility allows us to meet the needs of families and communities across the state. We're active in all counties. We have open accounts in all counties currently except for Wheeler County. And expanding the allowable asset classes will allow us to build off of that flexibility. National and local research shows that the combination of coaching plus financial education along with that incentivized savings is especially effective in changing individual behavior and creating those solid financial management skills, especially related to savings. It's the idea that while you're learning, you're also practicing and proving to yourself that you have the capacity to achieve those bigger goals that fell out of reach before, but with those small steps, you can reach them eventually. Portland State University Regional Research Institute has found that the majority of our participants through the Oregon IDA Initiative continue saving once they're done with the program, as well as report an increased confidence and ability in navigating financial decisions. We also hear often from participants, as you will hear today, that they have a transition from feeling overwhelmed and lost in managing their financial households to want a new sense of optimism and hope for the future, and that carries through with their ability to continue navigating those decisions over time. The initiative is funded through a 75% tax credit. That's why we're here, is it's set to sunset January 2016 as part of the scheduled review. All of those donations, which have reached the cap of $10 million over the past several years, are jointly overseen by Neighborhood Partnerships and HCS. Together, we qualify partners who compete for funding. We conduct annual on-site performance reviews and monitoring, as well as ongoing technical assistance. Through the network, you have a flowchart in your packet. This one right here with the blue. We work with over 100 nonprofits all across the state. The ones listed on this map are our 10 direct grantees. Three of them have networks of partners. The rest are primarily direct service. And there's robust referral networks that is not even captured in that 100 partner organization number. You'll also see from our demographic data on this lovely chart here, the IDA is 100 people, that we are successfully reaching households with very low incomes, as well as our participants reflect the diversity of the state below that 200% poverty level threshold. So in conclusion, IDAs are an extremely invaluable tool that partners across the state are using to leverage the programs they are already offering and achieve greater, longer impacts with families across the state in achieving that stable financial household. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Barger.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rebecca Barger. I am the Family Economic Opportunity Program Director at CASA of Oregon. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. I began as an IDA specialist in 2007. I have a very long history working with IDA programs where I was working at NeighborWorks Umpqua. Currently working at CASA of Oregon, I've had the unique opportunity to manage two of the largest networks in Oregon. And I've personally seen thousands of people work their way towards graduation through this program. Believe me when I say that there is no other program like the IDA. At CASA, we have two network IDA programs, VITA and Matched College Savings Program, or MCSP. VITA works much like any other traditional IDA program, offering asset building opportunities to the community that they serve, usually through nonprofit organizations, housing authorities, and tribal governments. MCSP partners with high schools, community colleges, and private universities across the state. I would like to share a little bit more about this program with you today. MCSP is offered to students who otherwise may not be able to afford to attend college. Research has shown that first-generation students who have not had a college-going parent often lag behind or feel out of place in college. Many do not know how to navigate through the complicated processes of applying for federal financial aid and often make the assumption that college is too expensive an option for them. These students make up at least 50% of who we're reaching through the MCSP program. Because students are working directly with their financial aid advisor or career counselor, they are able to effectively apply IDA funds in a way that will allow them to accomplish their educational goals with the smallest amount of student debt necessary. To date, over 500 students have paid for college using the MCSP program, and currently over 830 more are saving. We have also seen a huge influx in interest in our program in the last few years, resulting in at least a 200-person waitlist at CASA alone. We only anticipate that interest to grow. By renewing and expanding the tax credit, more students can be the first in their family to attend college and receive a degree, changing the trajectory for their families and themselves for a lifetime. It's my hope that you will vote to support 2011. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Are there questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We're going to go slightly out of order. As I mentioned, some of the various things, everybody has multiple obligations today. So we're going to leave the public hearings open on the IDA accounts, and we're also going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2662 in order to accommodate Senator Denbrough and Representative Williamson. After they testify, we're going to leave it open and we'll come back to the hearings on the IDA, just so that they have the opportunity to testify and get on to their other obligations. So I'm going to open the House, the hearing on House Bill 2662. Victoria, if you could give us a summary on that, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2662, which establishes Pay It Forward program, requires Higher Education Coordinating Commission to establish parameters of program by rule and for Office of Student Access and Completion to administer the program. Establishes Pay It Forward Implementation Fund, specifies that Pay It Forward program may only proceed if OSAC determines there are sufficient monies in the fund. Permits OSAC to implement limited scope pilot program.
Very good. Thank you. Colleagues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Michael Denver. I represent District 23, that's Northeast and Southeast Portland, and it's a pleasure to see you all again the second time this week. First of all, let me extend our thanks that you moved us ahead, and my I just want to say to the people from the IDA, we had a hearing in another committee on that yesterday. It's a fabulous program. I'm sorry to interrupt it, but this is a fabulous program, too, that we're going to be talking about. So the bill that's before you with respect to Pay It Forward is a follow-up on work that began in 2013 with House Bill 3472. And colleagues, no, I'm not going to give you a whole history lesson today, but I did send to you, and it's posted on OLIS, a PowerPoint that I did about a year ago, sort of presenting the history of what led up to that. Some of you here were very involved in that, Representative Wisnant particularly, because 3472, half of it had to do with Pay It Forward, and half of it had to do with another plan having to do with prepaying tuition at Oregon's universities. The idea of Pay It Forward, some of you may know, came to us from a class at Portland State University and a group of students who spent that session working on it and working on us to get that bill passed. It did eventually pass. It passed unanimously, actually, in both chambers. And it immediately went viral on the national media. It was surprising. It was the first time that something I was involved in went viral in that way. And I would say that it went viral and was on, you know, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, TV, radio. The reason that happened was for three reasons. First of all, the great story about its genesis, that group of Portland State students who were in a class on student debt and were searching for a way to reduce the onerous burden of student debt, and they came forth with this proposal, which resonated. Second, I think it went viral because there was a bit of a misunderstanding or an overplay on the part of the media. The headline said, Oregon makes college free, which, boy, I wish we could do that. But the bill essentially was, it directed the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission to study this model and to design, if the HEC deemed it worthwhile, to design a pilot project that could be brought to the legislature in 2015, which is what you see before you. The third reason, though, and I think it's really, you know, the fundamental reason that it resonated so much, is because this bill, you know, really coincided with an exploding awareness around the country of what a huge problem we're facing with student debt. The burden of student debt was hanging over our particularly young people and making it very difficult for them to start their lives, to start their careers, having this debt hanging over them. Pay It Forward, while obviously the media didn't know a whole lot about the details, just seeing Oregon go down this creative road was something that really resonated with them. And, you know, I know I've certainly heard from a lot of people around the state just gratitude that we're looking for solutions here in the legislature. The bill passed unanimously, as I told you, and the HEC then proceeded to study and did find that Pay It Forward was a worthwhile program and something that we should try to work on, and did design a pilot program. You'll hear more about that, and you'll hear from my colleagues the reasons that it was found to be worthwhile. But I will say they also did recommend that general fund dollars only be used for this if general fund dollars could be found. That is, the HEC decided to really put its focus on for general fund dollars, to focus on the Oregon Opportunity Grant, which I think we all know, or many of us know, just the huge benefits of the Oregon's need-based aid program. And I think, as I think most experts around the country recognize, that if you want to make a difference, if you want to bend, you know, the cost curve, you really need programs that focus on low-income students. That's where it can really make a difference. So what you're seeing before you today is a program that if there are general fund dollars, great, but it's looking for other uses of the state's borrowing capacity, its bonding capacity, to be able to invest in this program. And I'll just end with one statement. You know, one thing that we heard again and again from the students involved in this program was the idea of the state sort of fronting their tuition dollars, because that's essentially what this program does. The state fronts the money. They are very willing to repay the state, in order to really recognize the state's investment in them for what the state did in making it possible for them to go to school without having to worry about tuition. They were fine with that. They appreciated that the program, as envisioned, is kind of a reverse Social Security, right? Where Social Security, you pay, and then you get the benefit. Here, the benefit is needed up front. That's we need that benefit for students to go to school, and then they are very willing, based on their monthly income, to repay the state over time. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues. Be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Vice Chair Gallegos, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Williamson. I'm the state representative for House District 36, which is downtown Northwest and Southwest Portland. I want to first thank Senator Dembro for his leadership on this issue for as long as he's been a member. And I want to thank everyone who's here in the audience. I think the pent-up need, frustration, panic around access and affordability for higher education in this state is palpable. The reason, and many of you heard this story, so bear with me, the reason that I entered politics at all was I was a first-generation college student at the University of Oregon. And at the end of my freshman year, my financial aid was cut, and I panicked. And I went through the financial aid office, and they basically said, well, we don't have any more money to give you. And so I became a student activist, and it led me to Washington, D.C., where I worked for Senator Hatfield on higher ed funding and accessibility for college. And so this is obviously very near and dear to my heart. And I'm almost ashamed at how when I, in 1992, the numbers we were dealing with felt like a crisis, because we, in the last decade alone, the percentage of the university budgets in Oregon that the state funds has been cut in half. So between 2008 and 2014, we slashed our higher ed spending by nearly 40%. It was the fourth fastest disinvestment in higher education in the country. At the time, in 2008, we were 46th in the nation for our per student allocations. We are now 47th. In the same time period, tuition at our universities has doubled, and our students are shouldering that disinvestment burden. If you may have seen the graphs, you may see them later, that really show how we have just, dollar for dollar that we've disinvested, tuition has gone up. And so this is what's happening to Oregonians in our higher ed institutions. Are to reinvest to get to pre-recession numbers would cost $100 million. And that doesn't even get us to where we need to be. That just gets us to before 2008 spending. The senator mentioned how this became kind of a viral issue. And I think it's because everyone is looking for an outside of the box, bold response to this crisis. We can't do what we're doing. It's not working. And I'm convinced that much like the mortgage bubble, our student financial aid debt and loan burden bubble is impacting our economy, and it will only get worse. According to the university system in 2013, the average debt load for someone who graduated in 2012 with a bachelor's degree from a public university in Oregon, their debt was $24,000. That is a lot of money. And so it's limiting what Oregonians can do. It's limiting their ability to start their families, buy homes, buy a car. It's holding back our recovery nationally in the housing market. So this pay it forward policy is smart. It's a way to think about our university systems and our higher ed system in a very different way. As the senator said, it's a reversed Social Security sort of program. And what's interesting, we talked about the NEED grant, and the NEED grant is vital for low-income students. I was an Oregon NEED grant student. I couldn't have graduated without it. But this program is not need-based. So what it does is it really gives middle-class students and families access to higher ed because those are the folks who are being priced out. They don't qualify for need-based financial aid, and they don't have the income or the cash flow to pay tuition, and so they have to rely on loans, both federal loans and private loans. And that other really fantastic thing I think about this program is that when students pay back their payment in the Pay It Forward program, the state makes an investment on gets the investment on those dollars. So they are paying back to the state, and the state is gaining that investment to keep the program going. And those dollars are not going back to the federal government or to a private institution, a private bank, or the like. So it's a fantastic way to invest in our students and to invest in our state. I'm really proud of this bill, of this program, and the work that's gone into it, and the fire that has been lit nationally on this issue. And it's such an Oregon way to solve a problem. And that's what I think is so great about this state, is that we really look at difficult problems and we think, how can we think about this whole situation differently? And Pay It Forward is a very Oregon program. It is the Oregon way, as we like to say. And that's why I urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gallegos, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barbara Smith Warner, and I represent House District 45 in Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. I just have a few things to add to the words of my colleagues. I like to start with the idea that, you know, I know that this is an extremely different way of looking at how we financed higher ed, and that in and of itself will sometimes give people pause. But think about some of the ways we used to do things that we don't anymore. For example, do you remember when anytime you were interested in buying a car or finding a used something, you would look in the classifieds? Because who knew what Craigslist was 15 years ago? And that's a pretty significant thing. So this is a kind of a huge outlook shift in thinking about how we pay for higher education. And so I just want to talk briefly about how this fits into our 40-40-20 goal of higher education attainment and the people that I'd like you to think about who this truly can make a difference for. First of all, we have all talked about and focused on the concept of 40-40-20, on getting us to an educational attainment where 40% of folks have college bachelor's degrees or higher, 40% have certificates, and the other 20% are high school graduates. Well, that is because it is more and more jobs, and really getting and staying in the middle class is keyed to having those degrees. And the barriers that increasing cost and of loans and other financial aid are putting before people is a significant halt to that. Student debt also can disproportionately impact women and people of color. Women are now the majority of college students, and there's fewer good jobs that you can get without that college degree. So the other interesting way to think about the degrees is I will send to you some data from Eco Northwest that talks about how until 1980, the increasing economic status of people with high school degrees, associates, college, and masters all kind of went up together. And then since 1980, everybody else has continued to go up, but people with only a high school degree have flattened, if not gone down. And that is critical. You cannot get to or stay in the middle class without some sort of advanced education. Also, the new way of looking at this, of investing, the state investing, and then people paying back, is also particularly important for communities, first-generation college students, other communities where they are traditionally debt-averse. It is not they are concerned about the ability and the structure of taking on debt to finance a long-term goal such as higher education. And I think this will be a particularly important and useful program for those students who are likely to be debt averse now and just not have a family history of making this kind of financial investment. So I believe that the Pay It Forward pilot is a great way for the state to expand that access without increasing the risk to student debt. And I think it's critical for our state's long-term health as well as that of the students who we're going to help. So I hope that you will support House Bill 2662 and quickly move it out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'll direct this question to you, Senator Dembro. Although, if any of you have some opinion on this, I'll be happy to hear it. But first of all, I'll just make a comment that if I get a college education, there's a lot of winners in that. So the state of Oregon is a winner because I'm going to end up paying more taxes. The business that I work for is a winner because they're all demanding more trained workforce and all that. But truly the big winner is me when I get that college education. And so this is a very tempting program because you're putting the cost back on the person who truly really is the winner. And you know, that's not to say that the state doesn't have an interest in supporting that. But to get to more closer to my question, so inflation's been pretty low for quite a long time, with the exception of a couple of things. That would be health care and higher education. You hear phrases like spiraling out of control and all that. And so I'm trying to think of how this program I'll make a two-part question. What are the cost drivers of higher education? What is causing it to spiral out of control? And that's maybe a really big question, so you can glance off of that. And then second of all, how does this program fit in to that cost driver? How does it address that cost driver? Senator Dembro?
Sure. Yeah, that is a huge issue, Representative, and it's one that I think this committee is going to have to tackle if it hasn't already. I think I can just say in a nutshell that for our public universities, the biggest driver of the rise in tuition has been the state's disinvestment in higher education. You can see the graphs are very clear. The tuition goes up to the same extent that state support goes down. You know, there has to be a backfill, and that's where it comes from. So that is a huge problem, and obviously, Pay It Forward is not going to solve this problem if the state continues to disinvest in its colleges and universities, which keeps driving up the cost of tuition. So really, we as a legislature need to work at the same time on proper support for higher ed, and at the same time, the affordability, access to funding for students to be able to cope with what is already, I think most of us would agree, too high of a rate of tuition. I don't know if that answers your question.
I'm not sure that I agree with you that the state's disinvestment is the driver of the spiraling cost of education, because I mean it's a national problem. It's not just an Oregon problem, and it's a problem with private institutions too. So it's possible that maybe it partly does. And I'll just close with a little bit of a comment. I almost wish when you're making your case that you wouldn't have compared it to Social Security. That doesn't settle my fears at all. With Social Security, we collect the money up front, and we seem to have a hard time. Even when we have the money collected up front, we have a hard time meeting our obligations on the back end. And now you're talking about we're going to meet our obligations on the front end, which obviously you have to do with a program like this, but then we're going to try to collect the money on the back end. And that seems like a kind of kneecapping you to before you even get going. But you can respond to that if you like.
Well, I'll just say perhaps we could talk outside of this committee. I'm not sure if I can get you to change your mind on Social Security, though I'd love to, but I think I could probably get you there in higher ed.
Thank you.
Other questions for this panel? Yes.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gallegos. Senator Dembrough and colleagues, this is just a really exciting idea. I have some experience in this world, and we have to do something different, and I acknowledge that. But there's a number of questions that I've raised, and I've spoken to Representative Smith Warner at length, and will do so again. One of the things that's striking me as we sit here this morning, this is a $56 million investment over a four-year period. Is that correct? I'm looking at your chart that came up. It's a over time the investment of the state goes. No, actually, that's over 8 years. Is that correct? I'm trying to read this. Anyway, it's about a $56 million investment.
Chair Gallegos, Representative McCann. It's 16.9 in the first biennium. That's the only number I have solidly in my head.
Okay.
So I can't get beyond that off the top of my head. But
I'm seeing year one, 6.5, year two, which is the second biennium, 12.7, and then in the third biennium, it's 16.6, and in the fourth biennium, it's 20.2. So it's about $56 million. Anyway, that being said, one of the things that's striking me, we've had conversations in this committee over the last, since we started talking about recruitment and retention and how we moved students towards completion. And some of the ideas that are coming forward from national models about how we provide that support for students who enter the college world but drop out for whatever reason. And is there a part of this program when we bring those middle-income students in and they can opt in? It's a lottery system, I understand, and they'll have an opportunity to opt in if their names are chosen. That we can provide the supports for them to complete. If we're going to make an investment over a four-year period of time or a two-year period of time, are those supports in place in this program that are going to provide those counseling and advisory services that are going to give them a really good shot at completion so this investment becomes viable over time?
I can take this one. Chair Gallegos, Representative McEwen. As I understand it, no. That is not built into the program. But this is not a silver bullet for getting to completion. But what I do think it does is it relieves the financial burden, the stress of trying to figure out how you're going to make your next tuition payment or whether or not you're going to have to drop out from the equation. And I think that is the kind of stress that keeps students from entering in the first place, or the kind of financial worry, and keeps them from accessing the supports that are there. If you're working two or three jobs, you're not going to your counselor. You're not taking advantage of, you know, your study groups, your advisor, the supports that are already there. And so my hope is once this program gets up and running and students are paying back, then it will be self-supporting and we will have more dollars in the system generally to be pinpointing the needs of students to get them to completion. So I think it's a piece of a much larger puzzle, but it's a pretty big piece from an individual student perspective.
And just one other thing that has come to mind for me is we put a cohort group of 1,000 students together, and we start moving them through the system. I mean, the data collection to determine whether this program is successful has a very, very long horizon. Mm-hmm. So is the intent for this to be a pilot program for that very long horizon? Or, I mean, where do you see us being with this program in 5 or 10 years when we're not going to know if it's successful until this is fully implemented and the payback begins with a relatively small cohort?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair, Rep. McEwen. We certainly won't know everything that we want to know, for many years, but we will quickly know some things that we need to know. First of all, we need to know who is going to opt into the program. One of the features of the program is that it's open to everyone. And that it's not designed to provide special supports for individual students, because we want to see just what difference in and of itself the fact of not having to do tuition on student completion on time. And we'll know that within a few years, you know, in the short term. We'll know who opted in. There are some concerns that because this is an income-based repayment program, that people who think they might want to be engineers, for example, you know, where they could earn a lot of money at the end, and you know, they're not going to want to pay 4%. It's only going to be for those liberal arts students, who see baristadom as their future. I think many of us suspect that we will get a broad range of students opting in, but we won't know that until the program is created. There are a number of questions like that are really important. The other thing I do want to say also, one of the concerns about the program that came from national observers is a concern that if we do this program, then states will use it as an incentive to further disinvest in in higher ed. That is, because the students aren't paying it up front, let's shove more and more of the costs onto the backs of the students. And going back to Rep. Neerman's point, we as a legislature, if we do go forward with this program, have to be vigilant that not happen, that we have a maintenance of effort and actually an improvement of effort with respect to higher ed.
One more. I am just really delighted and excited about the prospect of doing something that's really innovative, and I really appreciate you. These are hard questions, and there are a lot of them, and this is a new program, and those questions will keep coming for a while. But I really appreciate the effort that you put into this over the last couple of years. It's remarkable, it's interesting, and we'll see where it goes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. I think it's clear, or it's important, too, to point out that what's in view here is not the trying to help students with the total price tag of their post-secondary experience, because tuition is a part, maybe only about 40% of the cost. So I think it's clear to point that out, too, that just because this, if in fact this would go forward, that this obviously doesn't take care of all of the issues, that students would still have to come up with additional income. But I wanted to get back to your, I think, Representative Dembro, you made a question about this wouldn't be open to everyone, or may not be, but I'm quoting from an article here that was in the Forbes magazine sometime this last year, but relating to who would this be offered to, and I guess that in order to answer that question, it comes down to who's going to be paying for it. Would it be the state? Would it be the institutions? Who's forwarding that cost? Because that could determine to whom we would want to make this privilege available. If the state is the guarantor, then I think from our fiduciary responsibility, we want to make sure that we have the opportunity to be paid back. So maybe we would put sideboards on what type of degree pathways would be eligible for this, rather than just perhaps everything that may not have a viable return to it. If it's the institutions, I think obviously they're going to want to make sure they get the resources back as well. So they would, again, those STEM-related degrees, those higher ed pathways that are going to have a higher ratio return. But anyway, let me just read from this article here. It says, one serious problem with this system is that it twists the incentives to graduate. Already 40% of students who begin a bachelor's degree don't finish. What will this number look like if students don't have to pay for their own education? In other words, what is the motivation to stay on track to complete within a timely fashion? When their education is being paid for by others, students will take longer to complete their degrees if they do so at all, and then someone has to pay for these losses. These deficits can fall in three places: the student, the college, or the taxpayer. If the student bears the difference, it defeats the point of the reform. Students will still end up indebted. If college pays the difference, they would become more selective by only choosing students guaranteed to earn high incomes, reducing the number of low-income students and students who choose less lucrative fields of study. So I'd be happy to get your comments on that.
Yeah. So remember, this is a program where the student does pay the state back for the state fronting the dollars. And, the payback, which is based on their ability to pay, it's based on their monthly income, is going to be free of the onerous interest charges that you know, that we often see when they have to take out loans, particularly private loans. They're still going to have as much responsibility and obligation as they ever would. It's just that they don't have to come up with that money at a time where they don't have the money. They wait until they are in a position to repay.
I would just say, though, I guess in a lot of ways, this seems like the folks who want to go out and buy the big screen TV or purchase what they want now because they want to have it. But in the long run, you're going to pay more back because of that percentage of your income over a longer period of time. You know, if you do the math on this, it's not a really great investment. But I want to get back just to some other touch on the process. You know, we did pass that bill in 13, and we did task the HEC with doing a study to see if there was any merit in the idea and so forth. And the HEC, of course, appointed a work group to work on this, and which coincidentally looked a lot like the original PSU group that came up with the idea in the first place, but that was just my own read. But again, the HEC then came forward with their recommendations, along with a lot of other recommendations for us to consider this session. But I think it's important to point out that, you know, Pay It Forward was really at the bottom of the list. I mean, I'm going back to the Oregonian article that came out in this past August, it said, where the headline is, Oregon's tuition-free Pay It Forward college finance plan appears dead. And then it goes on to say, Oregon's attention-getting proposal offers students tuition-free college if they agree to repay a small portion of the earning for years afterward got the official thumbs down from Oregon's Higher Education Board this week. The panel said Oregon has much more important things to spend its money on, including a huge expansion of need-based opportunity or financial aid, i.e. the Opportunity Grant, and bolstering community college and university operations than to launch a groundbreaking but potentially unworkable tuition-free pay-it-forward plan. So I just want to throw that out there just for context, because this wasn't at the top of the list for the HEC recommendations.
Right. So can I say one thing to that? Yeah, just briefly. You know, Betsy Hammond, the reporter who wrote that article, I'm sorry, but she got it wrong, and she did retract. She did print a retraction to that. She misheard what the HEC was saying. The HEC was saying, you know, what I said before, that general dollars should be focused on need-based aid and on support to the institutions, which, you know, I think most of us would agree with. But the HEC did find this a worthy effort to pursue, and she corrected that in a subsequent article.
Thank you, Chair Rep. Johnson. I can also quote you from the HEC report adopted September 11, 2014, in which the language is actually, after thorough review, the HEC views the Pay It Forward pilot as proposed by the work group as a worthy initiative for the legislature to undertake. So don't always believe everything you read in the Oregonian.
Thank you. I apologize for missing most of the discussion. It's next door. We appreciate you being here. We'll go back to our hearing on the IDAs now. Back to our regularly scheduled programming. Emma Wagoner and Yolanda Vanderpool, please.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Yolanda Vanderpool. I work for Neighbor Impact. Neighbor Impact is one of the largest nonprofit organizations in Central Oregon. I have been employed there for the last 80 years. Neighbor Impact has been offering IDA program since 2002. And the reason why I'm here today, I just wanted to talk to you about the great impact that Oregon IDA has had in Central Oregon. And as you probably know, Central Oregon has been one of the most hardest hit areas in the state. However, since 2009, with the help of the Oregon IDA, we have been able to help 62 individuals and families launch their business or expand their business, which is amazing. that's the reason why we're asking, you know, to expand this program. I just wanted to take a very brief moment and talk about one of our many, many participants. Her name is Kelly Loden. Kelly, a single mother, two teenage kids. After the divorce, she found herself, you know, struggling, trying to keep a full-time job while taking care of her kids. So one day, she was helping a friend who was getting married, you know, setting up the venue, and she just came up with this bright idea about how to string in lights. And that's how Illuminate Unite came about. That is Kelly's business now. She launched her business 2013 using only her credit card because obviously she didn't have any savings to buy any inventory. Soon after that, she learned about the IDA program. She was determined to make it successful, make it a go. So she participated in the program. She graduated a year later. After that, she was able to pay all her debt. She has a very successful business right now, and she is self-sufficient. So when we ask her about the ideas, what she has to say is that being able to participate in this program was the greatest blessing that she had, and also motivate her to really be committed to her business, her family, and be self-sufficient. So in conclusion, you know, the IDA has a tremendous success in Central Oregon. We have been able to assist many, many individuals, and the expansion and the, you know, sustainability is amazing. So, unfortunately, the last 2 years we have not been able to supply the demand. We had to be forced to go into a waitlist program only 6 months after we received funding. So that's the reason why we're here, to help us support this wonderful program. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Ms. Wagner.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Emma Wagner. I am a sophomore at the University of Oregon and majoring in Family and Human Services. Back in high school, I was part of College Dreams, a college and career preparation program in Southern Oregon. I didn't find College Dreams, but rather it found me and connected me to the IDA program, completely changing my life. I was poor and always on the edge of being homeless. Having a future was barely a possibility, and going to college seemed out of my reach, even though I so desperately wanted to go. When I learned about the IDA program and was accepted, I could finally see a future for me, and going to college was in it. My mother was a single mother, and having never been to college, didn't know any of the steps to take in order to start the process. The IDA program showed me in great detail how to file for FAFSA, how to apply to colleges, and how to manage my finances as well as my financial aid. I would have had to learn how to do all of these things, and probably unsuccessfully so, if I hadn't had gotten help from one of the advisors at College Dreams. I still have no help from my mother when it comes to college, and even now I will call the College Dreams IDA advisor whenever I need help with my college or financial problems and questions. When I signed up for the IDA program, I wasn't just given a college and financial advisor, I was also given a life advisor and supporter. College Dreams went above and beyond by connecting me to resources to pay for my SATs, my college applications, and what was really important to me at the time, aside from school, of course, sports. I couldn't afford to play sports as a child because my mother couldn't pay for it, but there were many years where being in the IDA program opened me up to additional resources that helped pay for the sports fees, and I was able to play basketball all through middle school and high school. Basketball was my happy place, a place where I went to be away from my troubles at home, even if only for an hour. Again, the IDA program was there to support me and gave me the opportunities I never thought I'd have. Today, the financial support that has been granted to me through the matching funds has lessened an enormous amount of stress. Because of this, I don't have to worry about finding ways to pay for tuition next term, and I'm able to focus on my classes and my future. I was poor. I was supposed to have nothing. All the odds were against me. The world was against me, and my future was drowning. This program was my lifeline. I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for this program. I wouldn't have been given so many wonderful opportunities. The IDA program gave me possibilities. It gave me hope. I am so honored to be here today to talk about this program. It gave me a hope that I never thought I'd have, and it is a hope that I so desperately want for people like me. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your story. Really appreciate it. Don't go yet. We may have questions for you.
I'm sorry.
Are there questions for this panel?
I just have a comment.
Representative
Emma, I just want you to know you're our hope. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's well said. Thank you, Representative Gallegos. Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Amber Starks and Janet Bird, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee for having me. My name is Amber Starks, and I own a business called Conscious Coils in downtown Portland. My business caters to individuals and families who need help around natural hair care service, so braiding, locking, twisting, and other African, cultural African hair care. My business also provides a lot of one-on-one training. I do small classes, and I also do consulting for organizations and businesses that need help around African hair care and African American culture. Lastly, I've created my own line of product, which I've trademarked called Coiled, and it's being sold at my salon currently, but my goal is that it will go nationwide and maybe even international. So much of my success, I would say, is due to three things. The first thing is that I really love my business and I really love my clients. And so since I've invested in my own business, I have a lot of heart for it and I put a lot of myself into it. Second is the passage of House Bill 3409, which passed in 2013. It's the Natural Hair Care Act that I worked along with my legislators so that people like me who do natural hair care can do it legally without having to kind of practice underground. And I would say, lastly, my success is due in large part to my IDA. I have a business IDA. I've been saving for the last 3 years, and this month is my graduation month. So I've saved the max of $3,000 and earned the match of $9,000. So thank you. So I just want to say that anyone who starts a small business knows how limited time is. And what I can say about the IDA program is that it's given me a lot of, it's been really flexible. So I've been able to accomplish my savings goal while also having the flexibility to do all of my program requirements. So it's provided me also with small business training, like business plan development. And they also helped me with financial education, which I was allowed to take at my own pace online, but it was still really thorough and kind of strengthen my financial education skills. I also got a lot of referral help, such as accounting and legal services, all of which that I feel like without the IDA program, I wouldn't have had the supportive services to reach out to those kind of services. So I also knew that anytime I needed assistance, I could call my IDA specialist and they would be able to support me or connect me to any kind of resources that I need. So not only have I been a recipient of the IDA program, I was also an IDA specialist prior to starting Conscious Coils. So I know that even the small amount of savings can make a huge difference in a saver's life, many of whom may have never thought they'd be homeowners or finish their education. So this program takes their small investment and it rewards them with not only funding, but also with personal growth in their lives. So they, like me, have experienced success. And so as I head into my third year of business, I'm thriving beyond any of my own expectations. I've recently moved into a larger space. Now I'm able to accommodate another braider. Hopefully that will help to also be able to help out all of the people who call me every month and say they need help and I have to turn them away. It's probably about 50 to 60 people a month that I'm turning away because I can't keep up with. So with having another person in the salon with me, I'll be able to accommodate those needs. And also, I'm starting a small supply store in the new space so that I won't have to send people out to beauty salons stores to get what they need. I can provide that in-house. So I will say the need that I had was funded through the IDA program. I never really expected to be doing something that makes me so happy and at the same time helps me to fulfill a need within my community. And so I'm just not sure how far along I would have been without the IDA program. And my hope is that this program will be around for years to come so that people like me can have the opportunity to start a business, grow a business, and see the success not only financially but personally. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Starks. Your enthusiasm is infectious. Representative McEwen.
Chair Reed, thank you. Ms. Starks, you're the reason we do what we do. And it's so gratifying to know that legislation that we passed in the last session is actually having a significant impact.
Absolutely.
I'm looking at your website. What you're doing is remarkable. And between the IDA program and the legislation we passed last session, it's so nice to see that what we do is helping.
Thank
and
you.
That it matters. And I really appreciate you taking the time to be here to give us your story and let us know that, you know, success is possible and you're a rock star. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, and thank you for investing in me by passing the bill last session.
Nicely said, Representative McEwen. Thank you. Other questions for Ms. Starks?
Just
Representative Reardon.
Well, I echo what she said. It's just amazing what you're doing. I'm just a little curious about how you got started, because it sounds like you were had kind of got the business started and were saving for IDA, in addition to all the other financial challenges you must have had. So how did all that work? How did you get started?
So, like I said, prior to starting my business, I was an IDA specialist, so I knew that the program existed, and so I told myself, why don't I have an IDA? And so just being an IDA specialist kind of led me to, you know, I saw other, you know, my savers being successful and, you know, using their funding for their businesses. So I thought, you know, I'm doing this. I might as well, you know, also invest in myself in this way.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Thank you very much. So, Ms. Bird, we've heard very compelling stories about the effect and the importance and all the good that happens. We're hoping that you can bring us a little bit back to earth to the bills that are in front of us, the changes and the various versions that are here. We're eager to hear from you, too.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird. I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and as you've heard, we've had the pleasure since 2003 of managing the Oregon IDA Initiative on behalf of Housing and Community Services in the state of Oregon. I am planning to dig into the details for you. So you have four bills before you, House Bill 2111 and House Bill 2112 were bills that were committee bills from House Revenue that simply extend two tax credits. The tax credit that funds the IDA initiative is a 75% credit on state income tax. So what happens is contributions come into neighborhood partnerships. Those donors are instructed on how to claim the 75% tax credit. We take all of that money, the full dollar, is essentially put into trust and distributed and allocated in consultation with Housing and Community Services on a competitive basis. House Bill 2112 extends a small tax credit that is provided to folks who use their individual development account to purchase a home, and it's essentially a little bit of an extra tax credit up to $2,000 that provides an extra incentive, an extra bonus to support home purchase. It's a fairly small impact on the state budget. House Bill 2011 was submitted by Housing and, House Bill 2441 was submitted by Oregon Housing and Community Services. It does both of the things that 2111 and 2112 does and expand some of the uses of the tax credit. House Bill 2011 is the bill that I want you to pass. That bill was drafted. Representative Reed is the sponsor of that bill, and that encompasses the renewal of both tax credits as well as changes a couple definitions and expands the uses of the tax credit. So in the materials that we gave you this one that talks about the renewal. The back gives you in detail what House Bill 2011 does. just to quickly go through the two technical fixes. As you heard, IDAs can be used to purchase a home for first-time homeowners. We're expanding the definition of who qualifies to be a first-time homeowner to capture folks who may have a dilapidated manufactured home, which we know are energy inefficient and often create health hazards with asbestos and other problems. So we would like to have them be eligible to be considered as first-time homeowners if they're purchasing a stick-built home or a newer manufactured home. Would also make it easier to transfer an individual development account that's being created particularly by a young person. So IDAs can start at age 12. If they want to transfer that into a 529 account, if there's a little bit of a gap before they go to college, this would make that the mechanics of that transfer easier. And we've worked with the 529 program to make sure that that works on their end as well. We would also expand the allowable purchases of the IDAs, and I'd be happy to go through each of them in detail, or is that what you'd prefer, Chair Reed?
I think the way you described the ones that are just simply extending the sunset are fine. I think that some more detail on 2011 it would be great.
Okay. So 2011... when we want to expand the allowable purchases beyond the five that have been talked about. And we spent a lot of time over the last couple of years working with that extensive partner network. As you heard, the IDA is remarkable in that it can kind of weave into existing community-based efforts that are reaching deep in to serve folks. What we asked was, are there ways that you would like to be using IDAs that current law is a barrier? And this expansion of purposes addresses those barriers that our partners brought forward to us. So the first would be Section 1E of 2011 would allow us to work with state agencies and, for example, youth aging out of foster care would allow folks to start saving for first and last month's rent as an eligible IDA purchase. Also, we have a pilot now with youth through the Oregon Youth Authority. Youth incarcerated at McLaren who are saving for education might also allow them to save for that transition back into the community.
Interrupt for a second, Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Are you working with the Independent Living Program for...
So we've been working with DHS, with their foster youth experts, and then we have a couple partners who are working in community with... I'm forgetting the name... there's a program in Eugene that's working with foster. I'm not sure that we're certain. I can find out. And
yeah,
let
as
you
students
know.
Transition out of foster care, they turn 18 and move it. There's a program called Independent Living, which...
On the coast?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there are a number of them around the state, but so you're integrated with that program to provide this information?
Yeah, Chair Reed, Representative McEwen, our connection right now is through Department of Human Services, but we are working with them to figure out how our resources fill the gaps in their resources.
Because what a wonderful resource you can be for those students who are moving into that next phase of their life coming out of foster care. Thank you.
Thank you. just to continue through the expansions. So, for example, an IDA that was used to create a small business, if Ms. Starks wanted to hire an employee, we want to specifically make it allowable to use that match resource towards payroll, just as you would use any business capital towards that expense. We're also Section 1I would like to expand to allow automobile purchase as an eligible asset class. What we see, and there's some really compelling research that's come out of the Urban Institute, is that vehicle ownership can be essential. It's particularly important in rural areas, but we're finding it even in the metro areas. If you think about the challenges of juggling transporting children and transporting oneself between affordable housing and employment. A vehicle may not be the ideal solution, but it is currently the practical solution for very many low-income families. We're also interested in allowing folks to kickstart retirement savings with an IDA. And again, this would be aimed at getting people into that savings habit. Thinking about retirement would layer well with many of the other retirement savings proposals that are being talked about. The next two purposes, Section 1K and Section 1L, address the need to help folks build safe and stable credit mechanisms and build up a credit rating, a credit score. The first would allow folks to, if they came into the program and were saving for one of the other purposes, if we uncovered a problem on their credit record or a credit score, would allow the IDA to go towards repairing the credit. The second idea is something called a paired account, and this has been piloted extensively by some of our national partners. And that allows folks to use a secured loan product to build credit while they're saving for one of these other approved savings goals. The use of these secured loan products can dramatically impact a savings, a credit score over as little as a year. And then finally, we want to be able to work with some of our partners who are helping folks repair unsafe manufactured homes and unsafe small homes. And so we want to be able to have the IDA savings be used to repair or replace those homes. And then finally, the House Bill 2011 does extend the sunset on those two, both the withdrawal credit and the initiative as a whole. This will go to the Joint Tax Credits Committee. We are hoping for an expansion in the dollar amount that we've been allowed to raise. We've been holding ourselves to a cap of $10 million for the last several years. And as you've heard, we have huge waiting lists in all of our partner organizations and a lot of demand, a lot of new opportunities that are coming to us that pose a lot of opportunity for impact.
Again,
I would hope that would be waiting lists of people who are donors also.
I was thinking the same thing, Representative McEwen.
So, Chair Reed, Representative McEwen, we do have...
If we raise the cap.
we reached our cap for tax credits on November 24th this year, so we have a lot of people who do want to make contributions. When we look at the range of donors, we see folks... we have a lot of former participants who contribute $15 a year. And like to give back. We have a lot of people who give $100 or $1,000. So we are popular on the contribution side as well.
It's really interesting how that cap works, and I invite you to correct me if I got it wrong, but essentially when they get to the cap, they just sort of turn off the website and the acceptance.
So we actually return checks, Representative Reed.
There you go.
That's painful.
It is painful.
Well said. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I did have a question. Thank you, Chair. Ms. Byrd, can you comment on the chart here? I mean, I'm just curious. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, a lot of the activity is I-5 corridor in Multnomah County, but I am concerned about rural community development. And can you just comment on that?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Reed, Representative Gallegos. We do see that we have concentrations of activity that follow the population centers. We have a different way that we look at this that I can share with the committee as well. We try very hard. We look at every county of the state who lives below 200% of the federal poverty level, with incomes at that level. And then we look very carefully at whether we're spreading the IDA accounts appropriately. Mm-hmm. And we have a few counties that we would consider underserved by that measure. Our percentage of IDA accounts is greater than the percentage of Oregonians living below 200% of poverty. The Mid-Willamette Valley, surprisingly, is one of those underserved areas. And we are slightly underserved on the eastern parts of the state. What this map really represents is also the spread of population. We are slightly underserved in Clackamas County, again, a little bit surprisingly, and on the North Coast. But that is something that we look at very, very closely and have for the last several years, and are actively encouraging our partners to expand their networks to reach that. We also look, which is what the circle represents, we look very closely at the demographic representation of IDAs and of individuals living in Oregon at that income level. We're very proud of our reach into communities of color and at the income levels of households that we're able to serve.
Thank you.
It's a good point. The it's not that the counties that are in white have zero, it's just less than 50. Yeah. I might have missed that if I hadn't looked carefully at the legend. Representative McEwen?
Chair Reed, thank you. And I don't want to spend a lot of time. I know we have many other things to do today, but I would be really interested how or if you are able to partner with school districts in getting this information to our young people through our public education system in any regard. If we're doing this down to age 12, are you getting this word out to our middle school and high school students? How are you doing that? How are you received in our public high schools and middle schools as far as how are you getting the information out to our young people? I guess that's a good way to say it.
Chair Reed and Representative McEwen, there are people behind me who could give you a much more thorough answer, but I'll give you my answer, and then maybe we'll have them come visit you. We do have a couple really remarkable programs, College Dreams, and you heard Emma Wagoner speak about her experience with College Dreams. They are a very robust program. They're based in Grants Pass, but they work directly with school districts, in schools. They're very much a model for us of how we can reach deep into the middle school and high school age population and serve students. CASA of Oregon has a number of really unique partnerships with schools. You heard Rebecca Barger speak from CASA of Oregon. NeighborWorks Umpqua has had a program with and that's our other network based in Roseburg. They've had a program with high school students also and middle school students also for many years. The switch to serve students age 12 and up happened in 2009, and that was the result of folks really wanting to get into the schools. So we don't have a formal relationship with the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. We've started to have some conversation. There's incredibly exciting research at a national level on the impact of savings on children's likelihood of enrolling in college as well as their likelihood of completing.
Representative Rudin?
Well, your education committee is always on top of issues like this. So House Bill 2847 actually it hasn't been passed yet, but requires Aspire programs to actually provide financial information and compare loan cost.
Representative McEwen, do you know anything about the Aspire program?
If I may,
please.
Chair Reed, I'm just hatching an idea. I think that's more generic. It may be that we want to go a step farther and require that IDA be a piece of that if it's not already. So it's something I would be interested in working. Mr. Brew is here today.
Yes.
We might want to have a chat about how we begin to integrate this specific information into the work that's being done through the Aspire program also. I'm a big fan of College Dreams also. So these are the more programs we have, the better. Overlay, work together, partner. But yeah, thank you.
That's our intent.
That's where I was headed. So.
Yeah, perfect.
Wrapped it up well.
All right, perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
In fact, we will be back to this question as well, and we now have all of these bills available. So thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on any of the bills on the individual development account?
Maybe no.
don't see anyone. They must be here for some other bill. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2011, 2111, 2112, and 2441. As you remember, we have the public hearing on House Bill 2662 already open, and we'll begin our list of folks who want to testify on this. I'll note that we're at 9:25. We need to be finished at 10. So those who are testifying, please keep your comments as brief as you can so that we can try to get through what is a long list. Let's start with Bob Brew, Rob Fulmer, and Michael Salvaggio, please.
Good morning, Chair Reed, Vice Chair Gallegos, Vice Chair Wisnant, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bob Brew, and I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion, more commonly known as OSAC. OSAC's mission is to help students plan and pay for college, and as the financial aid arm of the Higher Education Coordinating Committee, we administer the Oregon Opportunity Grant, as well as many other state and federal education grants. Under House Bill 2662, OSAC will ultimately be responsible for administering any pay-it-forward project or pilot program that's adopted. During the 2013 session, the Oregon Legislature passed House Bill 3472, which directed the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to consider the creation of a pay-it-forward pilot. A work group was appointed and met through August of 2014. I provided staff support to that work group, as did my colleagues Susan Deegan from OSAC and Donna Llewellyn from the HEC. The work was chaired by Commissioner Rob Fulmer. A final 36-page report was presented to and unanimously adopted by the HEC on September 11, 2014. Subsequently, a letter to the legislature was prepared by HEC Chair Tim Nesbitt and Executive Director Ben Cannon on behalf of that commission. In that letter, they expressed support for further development of the Pay It Forward program, calling out three specific advantages to the program. The income-based payment model is more user-friendly to recent graduates. The program could be, over the long term, self-sustaining. And Pay It Forward eases the financial burden on middle-income students who are potentially ineligible for most need-based financial aid. They recommended creation of a pilot program with the following caveats. Funds to support the pilot should not come at the expense of continued support for need-based aid. The state should design a funding structure that recovers the cost of the program from the participants, and before beginning the pilot, the state should carefully consider the costs and benefits of such a program to those available through any federally sponsored income-based repayment loan program existing at the time. While the final report I mentioned gives specific recommendations on how a pilot program could be administered, House Bill 2662, the bill you're considering today, is less prescriptive and gives the HEC some latitude to design the specific, gives the HEC quite a bit of latitude to design the specific parameters of the pilot through administrative rule. As an agency director, I appreciate the flexibility offered in this bill at this stage of development. What you might not know about my agency, OSAC, is that for 38 years, between 1967 and 2005, we were the administrator for Oregon students participating in the Guaranteed Student Loan Program, which was later renamed the Family Federal Education Loan Program. At our high point, we had nearly 100 employees monitoring and servicing these loans. This gives my agency some level of knowledge and experience in managing loan programs. While the Federal Direct Loan Program was replaced, FFELP is now run by the federal government, OSAC still maintains a small portfolio of other programs established by prior legislatures, including the Nursing Faculty Loan, the Paul Douglas Teacher Scholarship, the Medical Dental Loan Program, the Oregon Teacher Corps Program, the Oregon Nursing Loan Program, and the Nursing Services Programs. These programs were either straight loan programs or scholarships that converted to payable loans when the recipient didn't meet the service expectations they agreed to. While the Pay It Forward proposal is decidedly not a loan program, these other programs are instructive because they were funded for a biennium or two, but they're still active under OSAC management. Some of them were have not been funded for more than 20 years, but we're still monitoring them and working those programs. Any proposed Pay It Forward pilot would have a lifespan at least as long. To restate the old cliche, when it comes to a new program as potentially revolutionary as Pay It Forward, the devil will be in the details. And the same will hold true for any pilot. We have made an attempt to forecast the cost associated with developing a pilot, and some are fairly well known. For instance, we know we'll need some level of computer software, whether we are monitoring 500 accounts or 50,000. The variable costs will depend on the parameter of the pilot, and some of the questions we will attempt to answer as the program is developed are, will students be able to drop in and out of participation term by term? Will students be able to attend any public college or university, or will participation be limited to a subset of schools? How will participants be selected, and how can we assure selection is fair and equitable while ensuring financial sustainability of the program? How will we treat the income of students that get married and file taxes jointly, particularly if the Pay It Forward participant is not a significant wage earner? Will students in educational programs or schools that have significantly different tuition and fees be treated the same in the contribution or repayment phase? Will these obligations be able to be discharged through bankruptcy? How will we be able to efficiently collect from students who leave Oregon for other states or countries, particularly if we don't have any reciprocity agreements with them? Will collections be sufficient to fund the administration of the repayment program, even if the pilot does not evolve into a long-term program? And while they are not specifically related to costs of administering the program, other questions that are worthy of further exploration before a pilot is undertaken include these. How will these obligations be treated by regulators vis-a-vis consumer protection law? How will these contracts be treated by creditors in the Internal Revenue Service? Will the program withstand legal challenges? And if not, what becomes of the outstanding obligations? These are all complex questions with associated costs, both financial and administrative. Nobody wants to saddle students with long-term obligations they weren't adequately prepared to assume. Neither do we want the state to create a program that generates more cost than benefit, particularly through unintended consequences. I believe the process for developing a sound Pay It Forward program through statute and rulemaking, while potentially worthwhile, will be long and complex. Thank you for your attention, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rue. Let's hear from the panel, and then we'll see if there are questions. Mr. Fulmer.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. I'm here today to testify in favor of HB 2662. My name is Rob Fulmer. I work at Portland State as an IT specialist. I'm a member of SEIU 503 and represent non-faculty employees at Oregon's public universities and community colleges as a commissioner on the HEC. In 2013 and 14, I chaired the HEC work group responsible for evaluating the feasibility of the Pay It Forward concept. I am not here today speaking on behalf of the HEC, however. Attention to the Pay It Forward concept in Oregon arose out of student efforts in a PSU capstone course where students were tasked to try and find an effective means to combat the college affordability problem. Their work was reviewed by legislators at a panel held at PSU and found to merit further examination. Those legislators crafted HB 3472, as Senator Denbrough mentioned, which charged the HEC to study Pay It Forward, which was passed unanimously in both chambers of the legislature in the 2013 session. In the fall of 2013, the HEC formed a work group under its Student Success Subcommittee composed of current and former students, community members, faculty, HEC commissioners, and subject matter experts. This work group met in the winter, spring, and summer of 2014. In building the model to determine if Pay It Forward could work, actual Oregon Department of Revenue income data was used. This model was later vetted by Econ Northwest and found to be accurate. The work group also deliberated on the questions Director Brew has raised for OSAC to consider and made informed recommendations on them in its final report, which I encourage you to read in full. The HEC last fall unanimously endorsed the Pay It Forward concept as refined through the final report as worthy of investment as long as identified funds were not in direct competition with other student access priorities, particularly the Oregon Opportunity Grant. The pilot's intent is to verify the viability of Pay It Forward and test the work group's data-driven projections. We know the status quo is not functioning well for students. The expense of college is requiring most of them to work to make ends meet, which is in turn drawing out the time it takes them to graduate and see the positive results of degree attainment. I strongly urge you to move this bill forward and open up another route to help make college more affordable to Oregon students. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Salagio.
For the record, Michael Salvaggio is on the work group that developed the pilot proposal, and I'm here in that, and also a capacity with the Oregon Working Families Organization. The I had a PowerPoint, but I'm just going to forego that in the interest of time. House Bill 2662 does several things, and it's important to note, in addition to what it does do, what it also doesn't do. It creates a fund with broad receipts authority in order to kickstart the program. What it does not do is identify a source for these funds. In nowhere in 2662 are you being asked to put money into this fund at this point. We will be back once this administrative framework gets set up to work with the Ways and Means Committee and the Revenue Committees to determine where and how much money we can put into this to get it started. There was some confusion earlier about how much money is actually required to get this program up and started. It is very scalable. We can certainly do this with one single student. One lucky student in this room will get to be a member. As Mr. Brew mentioned, the administrative costs are going to be similar no matter what the pilot size is. Plus, this is a pilot program. We intend to get some data out of this, and for that reason, a larger group is going to get you better data. So we could do this with one student and have absolutely useless data. We'd love to do it with 1,000 students and get some very useful data. As the good senator mentioned earlier, as time goes on, we will get more and more precise with our data that's coming back to us. In 2 years, we're going to have information on what majors students are selecting. I know that Representative Johnson expressed some concern about what if we're seeing a lot of adverse selection. I think that in 2 years, if we look at the student group and 90% of them are engineering majors, then I think we're on the right track. If 90% of them are political science majors, as I am, then we'll know that we're on a terribly, terribly wrong track, and we need to fold up the entire program. I know that the bill also establishes the administrative framework and also the repayment framework. And we've worked very closely with the Department of Revenue to ensure that any obligations that are out there, the state has an ability to collect back. Certainly, a student could move to a small island in the middle of the Indian Ocean, and we probably wouldn't hear from them again, and we would not be able to receive payment back from that student. And we have built a certain amount of breakage into the system. But because this is a program that students are actively applying to, we will have the ability to have them sign releases in advance, which means that if the IRS knows about their adjusted gross income, we'll know about it as well. And since this is something that we're going to be able to tack on in advance, we think there's going to be a very fantastic rate of repayment attached to this. Frankly, I'm more concerned about a student who is walking home from graduation ceremony, gets hit by a bus. Please, everyone, be careful when you're crossing the street. We have built some of that breakage into the projections. Now, another question that has come up is if there are students who anticipate that they would be spending more in aggregate on their pay-it-forward obligations than their education cost or that their loans would cost, why would a student accept that that responsibility? And the answer is, in the financial community, there are several things that actually have value attached to them. There's cash and assets, but there's also time and there's also risk mitigation. When a student takes out a loan, they're saying, I know that that's going to be more expensive than if I just paid full freight up front, but there's a time value to money. And so that's something that we accept, not just as students, but that's something that the financial community accepts. That's something that all of you have pensions invested in. The other thing that also bears a value is risk mitigation. We know that there's a value to risk mitigation because as investments get riskier, as there's a lower assurance of ability to repay, that return increases. And so students looking at this option are then given the same option as the financial community has in financing anything it finances, to finance their own education, meaning that because Pay It Forward has a lower risk of their ability to their inability to repay that, there's an added value for them in that system. And so essentially what the state is doing is offering financial aid not in the form of cash, but in the form of the value of risk mitigation, because the state may be cash poor in sometimes, but we always have the ability to pool resources and to leverage efficiencies. And we want to leverage efficiencies for the benefit of these students. Another thing that I want to point out briefly is in terms of data collection, this is really, really exciting to me as kind of a policy wonk, because in 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, we're going to be coming back to you with the most accurate data that you've ever gotten. And the reason is this. When students apply to the program, we're going to have the ability to ask them to be tracked for a period of 20, 25 years, however long we feel that we need the data for, regardless of whether they get into the program, which means at the end of the day, as we bring you data on how the participants are doing, we're also going to be able to compare that to a group of non-participating applicants. So we'll be able to show you in very, very bright lines exactly what the additive value of this program is. And I don't think you get that with many other programs, if any.
I'll interrupt. Representative Gagos has a question.
Yeah, while you're talking about data, like Representative McHugh, and I really do have some concerns about the evaluation portion of this proposal. And you were talking about you could do one student or you could do 1,000 students. Is there a real pilot research design attached to this proposal? In other words, I mean, you need at least an N of 30 to do any kind of statistical analysis. Why not just say we're going to do 30 and we'll use this as a pilot, and even do control groups and really do it as a research?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's a very good question. And the short answer is the HEX recommendation came with a 40-page booklet. I believe that's available on OLIS that spells out a lot of those details. The lowest recommended pilot size that came out of that report is 400 students. Like I said, more students equals more precise and more reliable data. But the HEC did not draft a recommendation lower than 400. But obviously, that's within the purview of this committee and the legislature at large. And as to the what we're going to be tracking, what we're going to be looking at, I don't want to take up several hours going through the HEC recommendation. It is available on OLIS. That's for you. That's also for anyone listening. If you go to the legislative website, that's one of the materials that's been uploaded. But I'll just try to wrap up. I want to make sure that there are several things on the record specifically. This does not create a credit obligation on behalf of the state or the students. So what we're doing is when we have money into this pilot program, that will be absolutely the extent of the state's potential liabilities. Now, the say $20 million comes in the first biennium. The state will not be obligated to continue the program at that level with either that amount of dollars or that amount of students. In that way, it is very much unlike Social Security. But the
so did I hear you say a moment ago that it does not create a credit obligation on the part of students?
It is not a credit obligation. They are obligated to pay back a portion of their salary, but it's not a set debt limit. So, for example, if I have an obligation to pay back 3% of my salary every year, and I make $0 in a particular year, I'm not going to be obligated to fill that $0 gap later on.
I guess it's a terminology question, because theoretically you're still obligated to 3% of zero.
Granted, it's a term of art, and perhaps confusingly. The students will absolutely be obligated, and if they do not, if they think they're going to get out of it, then they will get hilarious letters from the Department of Revenue explaining why they did not get an income tax refund. But the at the end of the day, the state's liability is very, very collared to whatever goes into this program. If the repayment is not what was expected, if we realize that we have to make adjustments either to what majors this is eligible for or to students' performance, then the state does not have to maintain a particular service level. We will just simply say, well, gosh, we didn't have enough money come in, so this year it's only 390 students that we're going to allow participate. So I just wanted to make that absolutely clear for the record that this does not create an ongoing obligation on the part of the state or liability. I also want to point out that the campuses themselves will not see any difference in forms of money coming in the form of tuition and fees, except in who is signing the checks. They'll get a check for the same exact amount from OSAC or however that's set up administratively as opposed to the student, but it's still going to be the same amount of money. Because Pay It Forward is flexible, it can apply to either the student's entire educational career, or it can apply to just a portion. A student may say, I've got a good family contribution, but I'm going to need Pay It Forward for my last year. That means there's still a very, very strong incentive for the legislature to pursue a robust funding of the higher education system. And that, to me, was very, very key, because we don't want to take the air out of that balloon. We don't want to play hide the ball on higher ed funding. And the fact that this is only applying to gaps, to students' needs gaps, means that there's still going to be a lot of pressure for the legislature to come in with appropriate funding for the higher education system. I'll just wrap up and say this is not a bank breaker. As I went over before, the pilot size is flexible within reasonable limits. Again, we're not asking for funding at this time with this bill to this committee. We will be talking about that later on, but I think it's important to know that what we're asking for is just to move forward with an administrative construct and a fund that can accept money, because that has very broad receipts authority, and that means that even if we get a little money in at this session, we can even use the interim to go look for private sector leverage from charitable organizations, donors that usually give heavily to scholarships. We'll be able to say, instead of giving the same amount of scholarships each year, if you cycle that into this program, that's going to have a multiplicative effect, because that's going to come back into the program. The fund stays, it's cycled. This is a pilot program. It's an appropriate step at this time, because we have taken the projections as far as we can over the past year with the experts that we could round up, and we have some very smart people working on that. In the audience, we have some economists, John Gibson from the Economic Opportunity Institute, Mary King from PSU. Please feel free to call them if you have any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Unless there are, I want to be quick here, Representative Reardon. We've got a lot of people and not much time.
One thing I really haven't heard is from the standpoint of the students, and I see a lot of students out there, so maybe they'll shout at us or something, but from the standpoint of the students, would this program do enough to make a difference? And so is there like a dollar amount that you're targeting that would go to the students? Is it 10% of their annual cost, or, you know, what do we really need to do to make a difference?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to let the students talk to exactly what's going to make a difference for them on the individual level, but I also want to stress very, very clearly that this bill is not been introduced just to address individual student issues. This bill has been addressed because there are broader issues here. This committee recognizes that in its name, because it's higher education and workforce development. This is a workforce issue. And the fact that we have data that can show, and I'll be happy to share that with your office, that debt decisions affect not only students' decisions coming into college, but they also affect students' decisions once they're out of college. A certain level of debt, regardless of what your bank says your capacity is, studies have shown that people have a particular personal debt limit that they feel is appropriate. And so high student debt can address issues like home purchases. They can address issues like business loans. And I want to be clear that the students are going to speak to what makes a difference for them individually, but this is going to have broad-ranging economic effects as well.
Thank you very much. I want to move forward to our next panel, which I'd like to call David Reeves, Brianna Bertolio, and Drew Hatman, please.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I'm David Reeves, president of American Federation of Teachers Oregon. We represent 14,000 members in education throughout the state, many of whom teach in higher education at colleges and universities throughout the state. We recognize that student debt and higher ed funding are real problems in this state and have been ongoing problems for a long time.
And we really admire the committee for looking at innovative proposals like this one, Pay It Forward. But our members have some serious concerns about Pay It Forward that lead us to oppose the bill. And I'll go ahead and state what those reasons are. I think we really have to look at the high levels of student debt and the disinvestment in higher education funding has two interconnected issues, and they can't be looked at separately, one from the other. And I'm afraid that's what Pay It Forward is doing by looking at just the level, just student debt as separate from the funding issue. We like some of the ideas, I think, are very appropriate. Repayment based on income levels. If your income goes below a certain level, you should certainly get some kind of relief from payment obligations. However, that's appropriate for a loan structure. Really looking at interest-based repayment as a funding mechanism is not sustainable, and it should not be looked at as a sustainable funding mechanism. Higher education is for the public good, and I would say it has many, many more benefits for the state of Oregon than just to the individual. I think if you look at the level of civic engagement by those that have higher ed degrees, the higher level of critical thinking and analytical skills and what they bring, that kind of population brings to the state, along with if you look at states that have really invested in their higher education, say with MIT or Stanford and Silicon Valley around Stanford. These research hubs have really fueled the economy in those states, much more so than just looking at individual investments in somebody's degree. And I think that's what we should be talking about here, is how do we fund public education and what are the steps we can take to keep tuition and student debt lower. Go on. I think there are some issues with, as I said, as a sustainable funding mechanism. The representative mentioned by 2020, we're looking at $20 million a year. That's $40 million in the biennium, each biennium. I think that's something we really have to consider, especially in this state where we do have legislature tends to have very good ideas about funding higher education and keeping student debt down, but for various reasons, whether it's a recession or other reasons, they're not followed up on, and that's very disappointing. If you look at the Opportunity Grant 6 years ago with the shared responsibility model, very popular, I think all sectors of the legislature, all sides of the aisle, very popular, was never really truly given a chance. And I think now that we're seeing, or coming out of the recession, we're seeing funding returning, which is great. I think this is really going to help fuel the 40-40-20 other growths in higher education. But I think this committee should be thinking about that, about steps to really truly fund the Opportunity Grant, the neediest students, and should really be looking at priorities in that instead of, I think, idea like this that is basically flawed, that isn't sustainable. So I'll leave it at that we should be looking at the twin issues of high student debt and decreased funding in education has interconnected issues, and there are other ways, other priorities we should be looking at to really help students and higher education in the state.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Good morning. Excuse me. Good morning. I'm Brianna Bertolio. I grew up in
I'm going to interrupt just to suggest that you don't have to be that close to the mic. It won't distort if you
All right.
back
sorry
a little
about
bit.
That.
That's fine.
All right. Good morning. I'm Brianna Bertolio. I grew up in Newburgh, Oregon, and I was a public school teacher for many years in Oregon, and I'm now a doctoral student at University of Oregon, and I'm here today to speak on both the perspective of being a student and being an instructor of undergraduate and graduate students at University of Oregon. I would like to say that I really applaud the intentions and the motivations of the people who put this together, and I would echo many of the concerns they have brought up and the realities of being a student today. And I really support those intentions and motivations. However, I have deep reservations about this type of proposal. Representative Johnson really accurately pointed out that fees and tuition are only 40% of the cost of attendance. And I think many of you probably already know about what
cost to live in Portland these days and how that is skyrocketing. But maybe you don't know about Eugene. I think maybe people think of Eugene as the sort of pre-Fontaine era of this sort of hippie, quirky town. And I remember as a little girl in the 80s going to Fifth Street Market in Eugene, where you could buy handmade tie-dye shirts and honest-to-goodness granola sold to you by actual hippies. Well, Fifth Street Market is full of very few boutiques that I could never afford to attend at all. And what this is really ignoring is the amount of debt students will continue to have to take out to pay for rent and food and to support themselves. And it also ignores the amount of debt that parents take on in the form of loans, who would not be eligible for any of these sorts of repayment programs. And finally, I would like to say that I hear so often spiraling out of control costs of education. And yet this is talked about as if it's a tsunami. It's this natural disaster that cannot be, there's nothing we can do about it. It's just inevitable, like death and taxes. And I would really urge you to change that conversation. It is not inevitable. And if you were to talk to University of Oregon's own economists, they could point to many unsustainable practices and programs that are in fact the reason why education is spiraling out of control, and it's not to pay people like me. And I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Reed. Yes, and respected representatives here on this committee. My name is Drew Hatlin. I am a graduate student at Oregon State University. I help with student success working for the university, but I want to make it clear that I'm not here representing the university at this time. In lieu of my 30-minute testimony, I'm going to go ahead and cut it down to just a couple minutes here and point out two concerns that I have with the Pay It Forward program. The first, and I think it's already been echoed and shared here today, is the source of the funding for this program to really get off the ground. There was a large concern as to whether or not this program was going to negatively impact the Oregon Opportunity Grants and other funding sources that students that are in at-risk populations very much so need in order to succeed and attend universities and colleges across Oregon. But with regards to Oregon State University and what I've seen, especially with our large engineering population, is the disproportionate amount of funding that will be taxed or paid back through our higher end programs. When students start making more money, they're going to be paying disproportionate funds back to repay this program, as compared to, I think it was alluded to, a political science major that might not be having quite as much salary to donate back to this program. It's a concern that this might end up being a disincentive for folks to enroll in this program, or more importantly, enroll in our university. We don't want to encourage the bright young minds of Oregon to take their chances elsewhere outside of the state when we have quality programs here within the state that will really benefit not only Oregon's economy but also the lives of Oregonians here today. So I want to thank you all for your time and for allowing folks to give testimony on this important issue.
Thank you very much. Once again, unless there are burning questions, I want to try and get through as many folks as we can. We appreciate your testimony. I'll ask Brett Morgan, Kate Newhall, and Ramon Ramirez to come forward. As they do, I'm going to note the clock and provide whatever excuse our other colleagues need. I expect you probably have other obligations. If you need to leave, that's fine. I will stay as long as I can. We have, I'm counting here, we have somewhere around 12 more people who want to testify. So we're happy to hear from you, please.
Chair Reed,
Representative Kuhn.
I apologize. I may want to interrupt for a moment because of the time, the sensitivity of the time.
Oh, yes.
I would like to ask unanimous consent that we suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Reardon to vote on House Bill 3063. He was absent when we took the first vote today.
Thank you for that. Let's take care of that before people have to leave. Representative Kuhn has asked for unanimous consent to suspend the rules to allow Representative Reardon to vote on House Bill 3063. Is there any objection to that request? request? Seeing none, motion carries. The rules are suspended. Representative Reardon, how do you vote on 3063?
Thank you all for your consideration. I vote aye.
Representative Reardon votes aye on 3063, and we'll make sure that's reflected in the record.
Thank you. Chair Reed.
Let's continue.
All right. Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kate Newhall, here today representing Family Forward Oregon. And I already was watching the clock and took some strikeout through my testimony, so it's about half as long now. Family Forward is happy to be here in support of House Bill 2662. We support the Pay It Forward pilot because it will increase access to affordable higher education for all of Oregon working families, and especially for women. Women are especially burdened by student debt, and the problem of mounting student debt is compounded by the increasing cost of higher education and stagnant wages. While we think this is a problem for all students, the burden hits women especially hard because it heightens the persistent wage gap. Research by the AUW showed that women are significantly more likely to be burdened by student debt than men. Female graduates pay 53% of their income in debt, compared with only 39% of their male graduates. This is a serious disparity. Women, particularly working mothers, can be priced out of higher education when they face skyrocketing tuition costs. Low-income students and women are more likely than other college students to have dependent child care, dependent children, and high child care costs in addition to their tuition costs. These unmet needs are seldom included in the conversation about student debt because they aren't financed. Students are generally required to come up with the money for these costs, such as their family contributions, books, and childcare, in addition to the costs of their loans. Just keep skipping along. I also want to point out that you make higher income if you graduate from college generally. Without a degree, there's little or no earnings increase, and the student is still responsible for the debt that they've incurred. Pay It Forward changes this calculus so that working people have more security as they pursue their higher education. A strong and successful Pay It Forward pilot would be a step in ensuring that working families throughout Oregon can access higher education, and this is one of the proven avenues to improving their lives. For these reasons, Family Forward is happy to support 2662. Oregon's working families need access to higher education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Hello, Chair Reed and members of the House Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development Committee. My name is Brett Morgan. I'm an undergraduate student at Oregon State University, and I'm studying environmental sciences as well as economics. I'm going to try to pare this down as we go, just for time consideration.
Thank you.
So my parents were first-generation college students, and I'm fortunate to be a second-generation college student, which directly affected my outcomes as a student. I mean, I have greater security through support through my parents, as well as understanding how the system works. They were raised in agricultural backgrounds, and I've worked on farms several summers, so I understand the values of hard work and how you invest in yourself, and that creates an opportunity for yourself. And with that, I have strong concerns about the future of students and their futures in Oregon. In particular, how do we ensure that students are getting through the door and getting in the door, both of those factors combined. My parents' story is somewhat like mine, because I work full-time at the moment, 20 hours a week, as well as being a full-time student. I work part-time. And their stories are similar. They sit in some of the same classes I did, working to earn a degree just as I do, but I'm paying as much as 4 to 5 times as much as them. Even if I worked harder than my parents, working more jobs, living more modestly, and studying harder than my parents, I have less of a shot at making the economic American dream work for me. This isn't just me, though. This is a story of almost all students that are in this room and not here. A student can work as hard as possible, as I said, apply for every scholarship and ace every test, and they still lack the promise of generations that came before them. That promise is blocked with a huge financial barriers that is shackled down with debt. On average, as we heard earlier, a student incurs about $25,000 in debt in Oregon before they graduate. This number is not just me, though, sitting before you now, doing much of the same things my parents did. This number is meant more uncertain future for me. Education is no longer the definitive vehicle that moves generations to the American dream as it did for my parents. To most students, education and higher education means a delayed chance and a mere chance of attaining something like the American dream. While I have many concerns echoed by some of the people in this room about the Pay It Forward pilot program, I think it's a step in the right direction, and at least at this point in time. There's been talking about how do we fund higher education. A lot of those things we talk about are band-aids that can be cut year to year. We see continual divestment by the state legislature and state government in higher education. And the Pay It Forward program is the first thing that I've heard of that's a solution to this problem and not something that's just a year to year. How do we make this better for students in this biennium and so on? So I thank you for your time, and I urge you to strongly consider House Bill 2662 or the Pay It Forward pilot program.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. Mr. Ramirez.
See, thank you. My name is Ramon Ramirez. I'm president of Oregon Farm Workers Union, PECUN. And on behalf of our membership, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we want to urge a yes vote on Paid Forward, House Bill 2662. We overwhelmingly support this bill. I want to tell you a little story, and I'll cut it short. 12 years ago, I came from an agricultural community called Woodburn, Oregon. And we had a dilemma very much like the committee's dealing with right now. We had one of the highest dropout rates in the state of Oregon. And we had a decision to make. And so with the leadership of our school district, he pulled together a committee of community folks, educators, teachers, and some philanthropy people. And we all got together. And we came up with a plan, and the plan was very controversial, and that was if 80% or more of our school district was made up of Latinos, and many of them spoke their language, we have a community that has at least 70% or more of the farm workers are indigenous, meaning that they speak their own indigenous language. We have 16 different languages that are spoken in our community. Can you imagine? And they all go to the same schools in Woodburn. And we almost didn't make the decision because there was doubters. And we made a decision to invest in our community and developing a dual language immersion program. In 2015, that 12-year investment has paid off, and Woodburn has now one of the highest graduation rates in the state. And I'm proud to say, as a parent, my son is graduating this year. He's on a trajectory to graduate in June. And he graduated from Woodburn High School. He graduated of the 286 students that graduated that year, 250 were Latinos. And these were all high school diplomas that they were getting. So I know what it is to make a hard decision. And people are asking us today, how did you guys do it? How did the community go from the lowest graduation rate to the highest, right? And we made that decision back then. The other decision that we made is that all the community organizations that participated in that process were given a voice. And had a decision making, had a decision in that process. We committed ourselves to developing a partnership and a collaboration with our school district, with our educators, because I think we really have some of the best educators and administrators in the state. These are good people that want to ensure that every student's success. So our community has made an investment. We've done our part in preparing our students to become college ready. So that's why we want to support 100% the pay forward model, because we know there's a lot of questions still, but we got to take that risk. And I tell you, for us, it paid off. And we're willing to make that investment. Latino students, we know, we understand this. I understand this as a parent. We are more susceptible to debt advertisement. And sometimes that keeps our kids out of school from attending an institution of higher education. There was a time in the state of Oregon where we had more Latino students or young folks incarcerated in prisons than we had in institutions of higher education. And we're changing that. And we think this bill is a step in the right direction. I also want to state for the record that I'm a member of the Higher Education Coordinating Council, the HEC, proud member. I had the honor and privilege to hear reports on a regular basis and testimonies from the community, partnerships, from unions,
that came into the HEC and gave us reports on a regular basis on the progress we were making on developing this proposal. And I'll tell you, a lot of work went into this process, a lot of work. So I want to honor that committee that was put together to make the recommendations. And on behalf of our union, PICCUN, we urge a yes vote on House Bill 2662. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, sir. Any quick reactions? We'll keep rolling along. Thank you very much. I'm going to call up Kate Peterson, and then I'm just going to keep trying to roll down the list as quickly as we can. So as you get settled, Max Sneer, I think, hard to read, and Midge Purcell, perhaps you could come join Ms. Peterson, please. And please go ahead and get started.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Kate Peterson. I'm Assistant Provost for Enrollment Management at Oregon State University. I began working with families and students in how to pay for college in 1979. Thank you, Chair Reed and committee members, for allowing me an opportunity to share with you today some of the comments that I have received from the financial aid community across the state of Oregon. And they see few benefits and many problems with the proposed Pay It Forward program. Although proponents claim this is not a student loan program, it is, in fact, a student loan program, and one that can be very costly to the students who choose to participate in it. After graduation, a student's contribution to the fund is not limited to the amount of tuition assistance that they received plus interest. Instead, it's based on a set percentage of the student's annual earnings. And because annual earnings and not principal and interest are used to calibrate the student's repayment obligation over a very lengthy 20 years, students are likely to pay what amounts to extremely high interest rates. Also, there was a concern voiced that the Pay It Forward program could serve to discourage students because it will appear to them as a set tax or fee on an unknown future income, a tax that bears no relation to the actual amount of the funds that were loaned. In the financial aid community, we encourage students to compare the cost of credit from different sources. So in looking at the comparison of the Pay It Forward program and the Federal Direct Student Loan program, I'd like to give you some examples. The average student loan debt upon graduation from OSU in June of 2014 was $24,591 of the students who took out loans. And by the way, depending on the year, 30 to 40% of our graduates graduate debt-free. They have not relied on student loans. If this amount of $24,591 is repaid over the 10-year repayment period at the current interest rate, the total payout would be $30,500. The same student earning a conservative salary of $80,000 over 20 years under Pay It Forward would face a total cost of $64,000, well over the double the amount of the conventional student loan. The annual interest rate on the direct loan program would have to triple in order to make the Pay It Forward program attractive to a student earning a 20-year average salary of $80,000. Another example, one alluded to earlier today, would be a student with the lowest average starting salary of an OSU graduate last June, which was $38,000. So let's assume the unlikely situation that their income stayed at a low $38,000 for 20 years, then they would also only pay the $30,500 that they would have paid through the Federal Direct Student Loan Program. Clearly, we will be advising students to look at other alternatives and begin with the federal student aid programs rather than Pay It Forward. Most concerning, however, about the Pay It Forward proposal, it does not offer an opportunity to accelerate payments to buy out of the program or pay off the loan or consolidate with other student debt as provided under conventional student loan programs. Locking into the program is necessary to make the program work financially, but it creates significant burden for the individual students once they graduate and their incomes begin to grow. The other concern that was raised by the financial aid community is that there is no mention or the bill does not address the impact of students who use both Pay It Forward and the federal loan system, and which is a very distinct possibility given that tuition represents less than 40% of the cost of attendance for an Oregon resident. The administration of Pay It Forward would be very complex and very expensive. Instead of creating another loan program, Oregon's financial aid directors believe state funds would be much better spent on increasing the appropriations to the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, which has a proven record of increasing college participation and completion for those in need. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Before you get started, Max, I want to ask again if Midge Purcell is with us, please join us as well. Max, your turn, please. Just a moment. Actually, we have a question for Representative McEwen. Midge Purcell, please come up. Representative McEwen has a question.
Is OSFA taking a position on this bill?
Representative Reed and Representative McKeon, I'm not aware of the position that OSFA has taken on the bill, but I would be happy to give that for you if you would like.
Thank you. That would be helpful.
Okay.
Great. Thanks. Sorry. No problem. Max.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Max Neal. I'm 16 years old and a sophomore at Rex Putnam High School in Milwaukee. I'm here today to ask you to see that the Pay It Forward pilot passes. The reasons I support the Pay It Forward House Bill 2662 are pretty simple. As long as I can remember, my parents and my grandparents have always told me the importance of education. And every day at school, we hear again my teachers tell me and my fellow students exactly how important it really is. And every time I turn on the TV, I hear another politician telling us about how vital education is. And despite all of the adults who seem to talk endlessly about how important it is, nobody ever wants to fund it. My parents are middle class people. My dad is college educated, and they've worked their entire lives very hard in a lousy job market to provide for me, my brother, and my sister. They've struggled to get ahead themselves, so I don't see how I would be able to turn around and ask them to turn around and spend tens of thousands of dollars on my education. And are they supposed to do the same thing for my brother and my sister? I don't see how they're supposed to do that. The bottom line is my family is a lot better off than a lot of them, but they just couldn't afford it. I've read that in the 1960s and 70s, the state subsidized higher education so that anyone who wanted to and was willing to put in the work would be able to go. Sadly, that just isn't the case anymore. Several of my older friends have given up hope of ever affording college and settled for minimum wage jobs. Another one of them, he's working two part-time jobs in order to pay just a fraction of his tuition. I don't imagine that he can keep that up for very long. Most kids my age have even stopped thinking about college as an option entirely. Because, I mean, really, what's the point when you're just going to come out of it so deeply in debt, they're going to and probably end up working for a wage that won't be able to cover it? About a month ago, I wrote a petition calling for the passage of this bill. Just so you know that what I'm saying isn't one voice, it's the voice of many. In fact, nearly 100 of us, people during my school, signed this petition during lunches and during the passing of classes. Most of them are only a few years of being able to vote, so we don't just want it, we need it. If Oregon has no plans to start helping its younger people pursue a degree as it has in the past, then it should at least give us the means to take on the responsibility in a reasonable manner, not by dumping a bunch of debt on our families and burying our future in loans that we'll probably just end up unable to repay anyway. The Pay It Forward pilot is that sort of plan. Please vote yes on House Bill 2662. It's time that the government of this state, start taking its future, me and my fellow students, as seriously as it's always claimed to.
Thank you for your testimony. We appreciate you being here. You make a strong case, and I think you're a good example for some of your classmates. Please tell them they should come testify sometime too on other things.
It's a good
experience for us too. Before you get started, Mr. Purcell, I want to ask so we can keep our momentum up if Mary King can join us in that empty seat. She's coming forward. Ms. Purcell, please proceed.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mitch Purcell. I'm Director of Advocacy and Public Policy for the Urban League of Portland, an organization that's been advocating for African Americans and other Oregonians for the last 70 years. I will try to truncate my remarks to make time for other students like my colleague that just spoke. But I'm here today to support HB 2662, the Pay It Forward pilot, and I do want to emphasize it is a pilot, and I would hope that we wouldn't kind of pit one funding opportunity against another opportunity to make higher education affordable for all Oregonians who want to attend, but I'm here to talk about the student debt crisis disproportionately negatively impacts communities of color, especially Black Oregonians. And as I said, I will truncate my remarks, but I would like to just start with the fact that Black students graduate with a debt of about $30,000. And for many students of color, the prospect of taking on this level of debt is completely daunting. And they have to weigh up the value whether exiting university with this level of debt is actually worth it. And we know that good jobs in Oregon and those that pay well require a college degree. But we can't afford to continue to price students out of higher education because of the fear of this level of crushing debt. And if we're going to meet our recruitment goals, the 40-40-20 goals, we will have to lower the debt burden for students and remove the upfront barriers, which is such has such an adverse impact on students of color. And I just want to reinforce the fact that Ramon made about there are more African Americans in prison than there currently are in our state universities. We have to turn this around. I urge members of this committee to vote yes and to support Pay It Forward and support the pilot. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ms. Purcell. Dr. King, thank you for being here. We have your testimony, and I expect we will read it, so you probably won't be surprised by my request if you could hit the highlights, and we'll keep our momentum up.
Thank you, Chair Reed and committee members. I do appreciate the opportunity to address you and for staying to hear us over time. I have submitted much more substantive written testimony than I will address. I'll skip most of that, actually, and try and address some of the issues that have risen here. For the record, my name is Mary King. I'm a labor economist. I'm Professor Emerita of Economics at Portland State. You've heard the Federal Reserve has talked about what a drag student debt has become in 10 or 15 years on the economy. The U.S. is falling behind on other nations. The situation in Oregon is particularly alarming. As Representative Williamson stated, we're lagging the nation in terms of what we provide our students. And I wish Representative Johnson were still here. I wanted to address his point about tuition and what the drivers are of cost. If you look at the OUS figures, which I've been digging into quite a bit, tuition and fees now make up 3/4 of the OUS revenue, whereas they were less than 30% 25 years ago. We have absolutely shifted the cost of education onto the students, and that is what has pushed tuition up more than 2.5 times faster than inflation for the last 30 years in this state.
If you look, that's the story in the public universities. The private universities that people are worried about tuition is a very different story. And the economists who've looked into it point to a couple of things going on. One is the fact that higher education is what people call an experience good. You can't tell how good it is until years after you've experienced it. One way that the private universities are signaling how good their product is by making it as expensive as everybody else's. Your price is a signal in that kind of a market. The other kind of thing that's going on that people, Economist Magazine, all kinds of people have pointed out in U.S. higher ed, is the shift of higher ed budgets into administration, real estate, and athletics. And that kind of pressure also trickles down to the public universities and means that we need to be vigilant about keeping our money focused on our academic mission. So I wanted to make sure we made that point. Also, to your point about retention, so important, particularly with student debt, because you owe that money whether you finish with a degree or you get hit by a bus the day before, that I know our universities are making a big effort on retention, but also I've seen as a faculty member the role of finances and debt, the difference that that makes in people. I co-taught that class that PSU students came out of, and we lost a class member in the second week. He started to read all the news about student debt. He was already a returning student. He already had student debt. He decided the risk wasn't worth it. And the risk is really what we're talking about here. It's not anything else. This SHARES is a program to share risk. That's the way in which it's like Social Security. It's an optional program. It's cheaper for the majority of the students. You cut out the middleman. Otherwise, you pay financiers to share the risk, and they don't share. This way, we just pool it among ourselves. That's the point of it. Michael Salvaggio just pointed out to me, quickly made the calculation, he has the numbers at hand, that the previous testifier comparing the pay it forward ride was looking at pay it forward taking responsibility for the full thing with the kind of loan situation where the family has already contributed 60%. These aren't directly comparable, so I would direct your attention to the HEC report about what the payoff is, but the money savings with this is that we cut out the middleman, we cut out Wall Street. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here, and we'll move on to Erna Gellis, Aaron Brown, and Jeff Stewart, please. Aaron Brown and Jeff Stewart. Last call, Aaron Brown, Jeff Stewart.
Might be an overflow. There's a bunch of people out there.
Please, go ahead.
I'm going to try and be brief. I'm a faculty member. We talk a lot. My name is Erna Gellis. I'm an associate professor in the Division of Public Administration at Hackford School of Government at Portland State University. I've been here and in this position working with students for almost 17 years at this point. But today I'm testifying on behalf of the Legislative Committee of the Portland State University's AAEP. AAEP at Portland State is the fifth largest local organization, the association American Association of University Professors. What I want to focus on, again, trying to cut this down, is comments on career choice and on economic development specifically, because my colleagues and students and others in the community have spoken, I think, quite eloquently to the other issues. Career choice is an interesting one for me. I teach public administration and nonprofit management. I teach students who come to our program with this incredible desire to give back in public service. And I kind of don't like the references to political scientists, in part because what we're seeing with high debt is an attitude across the nation and across the state that you have to choose a career that will give you big bang for the buck. And so, students thinking that they're going to go into engineering or into business and make a lot, as opposed to going into the community work, working for the Urban League of Patriots, which is a perfect example, or some of these other partnerships. If they need to forego, with high debt, students are oftentimes feel that they need to forego giving back to society because they just can't afford it. So I want to emphasize that that's a concern. We have heard a lot about the average debt here in Oregon for students, and that average means that there are a lot of students who owe a lot more. And I'll give one example, a student in my class a couple of years ago who said that she was engaged, and that between her and her fiancé, they had over $90,000 in student debt. And I was aghast. I mean, I'd read about it, but I was talking to a human being for whom starting a family, buying a house, doing any of those things that contribute back to us as a society weren't going to happen for the foreseeable future, or may never happen because you lose the capacity to do some of those things. So she's not a sample size of one. I want to emphasize that. That kind of debt that students are taking on also is potentially crippling. If you miss a car payment, if you miss a mortgage payment, if you miss a credit card payment, even some of the protections on credit cards I've seen, because occasionally I sort of lose track of the bill, and all of a sudden that $35 or, you know, but I'm in a place where I can negotiate it. I'm in a place where I can call and say, I pay my bills on time, and they remove that. Our students aren't in that position. And that then makes them all the less able to buy that home, to get that mortgage, to buy the car, to contribute back. So I think that that's an important piece to consider. So we want to emphasize that AAUP, Portland State, deems this to be a forward-thinking piece of legislation. It's a flexible plan that will nourish our future citizens. It will help them to avoid the bad credit trap that stops them in their boots, if I may use a cliche. It won't fix the problem for everyone, but it's a meaningful step forward, and it's creative, and it's in the Oregon tradition of pioneering and doing something that I think with this pilot, with the adjustments that can happen over time, can make it incredibly successful. It's not perfect, but it's a real step forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gales. Let's see if we can fill that empty seat before we hear from you, Aaron. Is Jeff Stewart in the room now? Don't see him, so we're going to move on. Mike Jones. Okay. Alyssa Ciampi. Okay. Lamar Wise. Okay. Please go ahead, Mr. Brown. Mr. Wise is getting set.
Good morning, Chair Reed, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Brown, and I am here today to urge your support for House Bill 2662, the Pay It Forward pilot. I currently serve as the outreach coordinator for the Oregon Bus Project. We're an organization that's focused on engaging young people in the democratic process by making it fun and engageable.
It looks like you might be reading your testimony. We've got it. So if you could,
my next line is, I'm largely going to skip the rest of
testimony. Thank you.
It's written in blue.
You're very good. Thank you.
But I encourage you to look at the written testimony. The one thing I would like to say is that, I really encourage you to listen to the voices of many of the youth that came down here today. I thought Max's testimony was fantastic. There's working with young people here in Oregon. I get the opportunity to meet a lot of folks who are desperately thinking about, like, how they're able to afford college and how they're able to, desperately looking for an opportunity to afford college, and we need more policies like the Pay It Forward opportunity to look at. I'll just throw out really quickly that Oregon is disappointingly 47th in public higher education spending, and tuition in the United States has risen by over 1,000% in the last 30 years. Graduates on average have $27,000 in debt and have to compete for low-wage entry-level jobs in a job market that is slow to recover. I'm going to cede the rest of my time to the rest of my testimony, but the Oregon Bus Project is firmly in support of the Pay It Forward pilot, so thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for your testimony and for being so concise. Mr. Wise.
Yeah. Is this good?
That's perfect.
Okay, great.
That's perfect.
Hi, Cherry and members of the committee. My name is Lamar Wise. I'm a student at the University of Oregon. I also sit on the HEC as the student representative for the universities. I was in a working group for Pay It Forward. I would like to make clear that I'm not here on behalf of the HEC, but I am here as a student. in support of this bill and of the concept. And I also represent the Oregon Student Association, who took a positive stance for this as well. I just wanted to quickly go back to some of the things that were said earlier, but basically Representative Williamson talked about how this bill can affect students and how the current debt and the current way of life for students has gotten to a point where, in my opinion, is just absolutely ridiculous and is harmful for us as Oregon residents and as just citizens of the U.S. who want to contribute positively to our communities and to the society here. So I wanted to thank you for bringing that up, because I am that student that did have to be on a couch for 6 months. I'm the student that did see their balance at zero, like their bank account balance at zero. And I'm also the student that has had to decide between food or buying books. And which one do you think I chose? These are very serious issues and this is not just me that I'm speaking for. This is issues that pertain to many students on my campus and around the state. And so that's why I think that this is a innovative solution that we should look forward towards. I currently have two jobs now. Both my parents are working. We're a middle class family. I guess I'm asking, like, what more do you want from students like me, from people like me, who do the right thing, or who are supposed, like, trying to do the right thing, but still end up short. I think that means that the current system is not working. And we should start finding new ways to address the solution or to address the problem of student debt and the ever mounting pressures of being a student and trying to pay for college. Again, this is a pilot program, and I think this is an opportunity for Oregon to be a leader in innovating funding for higher education. And I think you all should pass this out of committee with a due pass recommendation. I'm available for any questions.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here. Appreciate your testimony. If there are any quick questions, we could try to accommodate them, but we've got a few more to go. So thank you very much. Next on our list, Kevin Rackham. Pausing just to see if someone stands up. Okay, I don't see him. John Russell, I see you. And Jeff Anderson, I see you. Your turn. And Dan Clay.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I'm John Russell. And I appreciate the chance to chat with you about the Pay It Forward program. And I'd like to relate this bill to the circumstances of our own family, just to illustrate the severity of the problem. Our son-in-law is a 45-year-old federal public defender with a terrific job, relatively high income, and a steady job. But he grew up African-American in a low-income family in Alabama, and as a result, by putting himself through school with work and loans, he has a loan balance of a couple hundred thousand dollars. As a result, he's never been able to buy a home. The contrast with our younger daughter, who's 35 years old, she and her husband are teachers. Their combined income is less than our son-in-law, but because of the fact that Mary and I were able to pay for their education, they have a home. They have the opportunity to participate in the American dream, accumulate net worth, and have a stable source of funding for their home loan. And I just, this illustrates not a solution to the problem, but it indicates the severity of the problem, and this is clearly not unique. It just seems to me like a pilot program which fleshes out the difficulties of this legislation seems like a no-brainer when you compare it to the status quo, which clearly isn't working.
Thank you. We appreciate the story and the brevity.
Mike, written comments are already in your hands, and so I'm going to be brief.
Okay.
Chair of the committee, or chair members of the committee, my name is Jeff Anderson. I'm the chair of the Oregon Working Families Party.
And Jeff, you can push the microphone a little farther away. It won't distort quite as much.
Okay.
Thanks.
I'm just going to throw some numbers out, and I've heard them through the day, but in testimony, but 27,075, 47th in the 50 states ranking in education. I find embarrassing as a native Oregonian whose first member went to higher ed in 1892 at the College of Oregon Agriculture, now OSU. $27,000 debt. When I find that 75% of the school is funded by tuition, from hearing that from earlier testimony, where 25 years ago that was 25%, I guess I heard testimony of a graduate student from University of Oregon. I want to respond that I want to channel Steve Prefontaine. I watched him run in my day, which was exciting. You would never know that I was a cross-country runner today. But, he ran forward. And quite frankly, I'm just going to summarize and say HB 2662, Pay It Forward, is in the same spirit of doing something that puts us on the edge. It certainly made University of Oregon track program famous. I think Oregon should be a leader in Pay It Forward. Gives us the opportunity to be out on the cutting edge of something that I think is exciting, and I don't believe the sky will fall. I've been hearing that. I'm just confident it won't fall. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Clay.
Hello, my name is Dan Clay, Chair Reed and committee. Thank you for listening to my testimony. I'm here representing 20,000 UFCW members spread out all over Oregon. The thing I wanted to talk about was the opportunity of people coming together, such as in a labor union, to build better lives and to create opportunity. And that is what I think this bill is about. I think we really miss the point if we don't focus on providing the opportunity for Oregon students and for Oregon itself. It's not just about the students. It's about having a workforce that's educated so that Oregon can thrive. Being able to graduate in a debt-free or in a lesser debt position is a huge benefit, and I think that's been well covered, and so I'll skip my comments on that. One thing I do want to bring up in closing that I find challenging. There's been a lot of talk about whether or not we're happy if engineers do this, or if we're happy with people who are in political science doing this, based on the income. But I would encourage you to think about folks that are social workers who work with foster kids in Oregon. They have a four-year degree, and I believe they have to have a master's degree to be able to do that, and I know they don't get paid a whole lot. But just because they don't get paid a whole lot, and just because the return would not be as great, does not mean it's any less of a value to Oregon. So I appreciate you taking the time to listen to me. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
I will say,
Representative Gagos.
Well, thank you for calling out social work. It is Social Work Month, March. And
I got to apologize to you, Representative Gagos. Yesterday, when Wednesday, I think someone made a reference to you being a professor, and I said sociology, thinking social work. Oh, I know there's a difference, and I apologize for that. Social work. He's
all
a
right.
Professor of social work.
Yep.
That completes our list of people who have signed up to testify. Recognizing that it's almost 45 minutes past our original time, is there anyone else who feels compelled to testify today? Don't see anyone. So I'm gonna
Can I make one comment?
Representative Williamson.
So I know the chair said he was coming in and out of a hearing next door, and it was on retirement security. And I find it so interesting and potentially ironic that here we're talking about the debt burden of students and how it sets them back for the rest of their lives. And in the next room, we're talking about the number of people who are retiring into poverty and how that's a threat. threat to our state. And it just was an interesting set of hearings to be having at the same time.
They're connected, aren't they? With that, we close the public hearing on House Bill 2662. And my great thanks to all of you committee members who stuck through. We heard some good testimony, and I appreciate you all being here. We'll see you all on Monday. Have a great weekend. We're adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.
Weekend, we're adjourned.